Now, for something completely different, here is your host, Brian Wilson.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, people of all sexes, and especially to all of you who have gotten a sugar high from the singing tubby and the Jardiance commercial, welcome to the Super Duper Pooper Scooper Tuesday episode of The Two and Only, when otherwise reasonably sentient beings and neighbors will take part in deciding who will tell them how to live, what to own, how to travel, what to eat, say, and do, and think for the next 4 years. All the MSM giants are fully invested in 24 hours worth of myopic redundancy, pointless blathering, and bloviating, as if the final tabulations actually matter, all while posing and preening for a clueless audience. Meanwhile, your loyal Two and Only once again are prepared to share and comment on the important things in life, like, why did a nearly famous beer lover give up on Raging Bitch? Where is Meghan Markle going on vacation? Do Jamie Raskin and Adam Schiff really share a rubber room near the Capitol? All that and more coming up as once again we slide down the razor blade of life into the Hall of Mirrors at the Narcissism Museum near the reflecting pool in the logic-free zone. Co-starring in this week's production, sincerely yours, Brian Wilson, often mistaken for the rock and roll legend, Mick Jagger, and celebrating his triumphant return from the massive book signing appearance at the Dundalk Little Shop of Horrors and Illiteracy Clinic, where he very slowly read selected passages from his latest bestseller, Last Rites, The Death of American Liberty. As the New York Post's sharpshooter of uncomfortable opinions, this week's winner of the Professor Dumbledore lookalike pageant, let's have a welcome for the digitally dexterous James Bovard.
Brian, thanks for the that nice lead-in. I'm trying to think where the beard kicked in, but maybe I was maybe I missed a step. Yeah. I miss steps these days.
Well,
I've been watching
not,
too many.
You're obviously
videos.
Not a Harry Potter fan, otherwise you would have.
That's true. Okay, yeah, I'm totally. I mean, that's Greek to me. I mean, Aristophanes, maybe Harry Potter, no.
Yeah, well, if you look up Professor Dumbledore, you know, and you're on your Google or something, I'm sure you'll see a picture of both of him. He was two different actors. He was originally played by Richard Harris, whom I interviewed in New York before all that started. It's a great story about how he came to the interview, and he was he and the Jack Daniel's distillery had a lot in common at that particular moment. 9 o'clock in the morning.
There are three different jokes which I've vetoed here, but I'll just sit here and nod. just trust me, I'm nodding. Okay.
Well, it was interesting because when he got up and left, and we had a great time. I don't know if you recall, he had a questionable pop hit called MacArthur Park, along with his acting credentials. This was back in the 60s, 70s, whenever that came out. Anyway, when he left, we were cleaning up, you know, getting ready to move out for the next shift, and there's his wallet lying on the floor. And I kind of figured it was his. Nobody else was in the studio. And it had like $1,500 in cash in it with a bunch of other stuff. So I called his agent who had set up the booking and called him. And needless to say, he was most grateful. But that's my brush with greatness with Richard Harris, a.k.a. Professor Dumbledore in the highly successful Harry Potter movies.
$1,500 was real money back then.
Oh yeah, 1982, 1883. That was serious dinero. But anyway, here we are, Super Tuesday, and I hope you have your new Trump sneakers all laced up, Jim. I'm sure you got them here.
I think I'll stay with New Balance at least until Election Day. So,
Well, that's probably a good idea. I think I got a pair of those, but I'm looking at those ones. I don't remember the name of the manufacturer, but the ones where you don't have to lace them up, you just step into them and you're off and running. I think I kind of like those, all things considered. But anyway, one of the overriding themes and a revelation for many in Last Rites is the government's overriding disregard for its primary purpose to protect the rights and citizens who put it in place and from whom it supposedly derives its just powers from the consent of the governed, according to Thomas Jefferson. But that's a theme that that surrounds just about everything that you've written since I've known you. And that goes back to Lost Rights, which was like 30 years ago. And one of which is apropos of that, 4 years ago, almost to the day, the folks over in Montgomery County, the SWAT team over there, murdered Duncan Lemp. And since you're about the only person I know or have read who to repeatedly take up the story and the scandal, Most people probably don't have a real clue about who he is or what happened or what the problem is. So up pops an article in American Conservative you wrote that gives kind of the history and overview of what happened and where it is and so on. So I thought for our discussion today, for a little bit, maybe you could give us an overview of that whole story and what happened.
Yeah, Duncan Lemp was a 21-year-old software developer. He was living in his mother's house in Potomac, Maryland. Potomac is a very affluent suburb of Washington, D.C. He was outspoken on the internet. He was in favor of the Second Amendment. He had libertarian leanings. There were the police had a couple confidential informants, dogging him. And he made some comments that he didn't trust the police, anti-government, anti-police comments. The government also claimed that he owned an illegal assault weapon, but that was based on looking at a picture on Instagram, which the government misidentified. And that was basically sufficient for the government to launch a no-knock raid at 4:41 a.m. on March 12, 2020, that started out by having a policeman smash in his Lemp's bedroom window where he was laying sleeping next to his pregnant girlfriend and throwing in two flashbang grenades. These flashbang grenades are as loud as four shotgun blasts. They've killed and maimed a lot of people over the years because SWAT teams are so reckless with using them. And so here's someone asleep at 4:41 a.m., The window gets smashed in, the bombs go off, the flashbangs go off right next to him and his girlfriend. Then a cop steps up and shoots him three times. At the same time, a second group of policemen come in on the other side, smashed in the front door, and typical no-knock raid. And so he was laying there, shot three times. He was still alive. He was gasping for breath. His eyes were open. And instead of first aid, a policeman walks over and puts his boot on Lemp's neck.
In true George Orwell fashion.
Indeed. George Orwell had said, if you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. And, I don't know if Duncan Lemp had heard or read that line before he was killed, but it was far too close to home.
Well, there's a number of things about that entire scenario as you mapped it out, as it happened, that raised a couple of questions. First, the most obvious one, especially in harmony with the Fourth Amendment and due process, based on a picture on the internet of even if it was a real assault rifle, so-called assault rifle, without any attempt to talk to the guy or ask him or interview him or anything, they just go to the house, break the window, chuck in the flashbangs, and shoot him. That really gets above and beyond anything that could be a stretch of reality or reasonableness, rather. But the one thing I immediately thought of was this was kind of like shades of Waco, when they could have sat down and had a chat with David Koresh on any one of a number of occasions. In fact, the local sheriff did, went out to the rifle range and popped off a few rounds, that kind of business. But instead, they just go rolling up with their trucks and guns and the shooting starts and the rest is history. So I'm just wondering did Montgomery County take a cue from the BATF and the FBI out at Waco, or is this just getting to be standard operating procedure?
I don't know, but for Waco, David Koresh actually went target shooting with undercover ATF agents 8 or 9 days before the ATF attacked his house.
Yeah.
And Koresh knew they were undercover ATF. And there was an ATF agent who filed a memo that said that Koresh had talked about the right to bear arms and resist government power if government was tyranny. So, the thing about reading about this case and looking at some of the recent court filings, because there was a wrongful death lawsuit now, it was easier for Montgomery County Police to kill Lemp than to talk to him or talk to him and his parents. They had plenty of chances. There was a policeman surveilling the house at least on the day before the pre-dawn attack. But they didn't bother, because, well, I think that they, I was going to speculate on what the police on what their real intent was, but they have managed to cover it up almost completely for 4 years. And this Montgomery County is one of the most liberal counties in a liberal state, totally Democratic. And so, and the police union is very strong here. So all those things together, cops killed a gun owner, shot him without warning in his own bedroom. Not a problem. He was anti-government. So, you know.
Well, that's the thing. It's kind of confounding to the point that they would do that, but specifically reference to your covering up and, you know, for 4 years, obviously it doesn't take a leap of logic to come to the conclusion that when people are trying to cover something up, they got something to hide. But with this much information out there, along with the speculation that you didn't stipulate, I'm just curious as to what else could there be that would even begin to approach a justification of these kind of violations?
Well, Maryland has long been one of the worst states in the country for police abuses. There was something, Maryland, I think, was the first state to pass something called the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, which basically is, and works out to be a license to kill in many cases. Washington Post had a great series on this, how this law was working in Prince George's County back in 2001. And it talked about how as soon as a policeman shot somebody, there was a lawyer there real quick from the police union to make sure that no one talked to the policeman who shot the guy, because the policeman was entitled to wait 10 days before answering any questions. And what happens in many locales is that the cops who shot somebody have access to all the evidence which comes in, and that allows them to frame their story and escape any legal liability for killing innocent citizens.
Yeah, really. Well, you know, you see that what it sets up in my mind is a kind of a dichotomy. Is that on one hand, we've got all these stories of all this type of outrageous action, violation of rights, outright murder, and so on. And on the other hand, you know, we have certain members of the media and a large chunk of the population that are all gung-ho, you know, in favor of the police, that these are the people that keep us safe. They stand between us and chaos and credibility and all these horrible things happening. And it's only a few of these and a few here and a few there that are the bad actors. But the stories, if you look for them, because they don't generally make the networks or the front page news and nobody's reading the paper anyway, you know, they're a lot more prolific than they would appear to be. When you mentioned the flash bang, I remember there was a story, I believe it was from California or Oregon, where they pulled a stunt like that a few years ago. The flash bang wound up in a baby's crib.
Yep.
When
yep.
it went off.
That's happened a number of times.
And
Babies have been maimed. Kids have been killed. A lot of cases of houses being set on fire with these things. And the cops go in and you know, the SWAT teams are often completely reckless, partly because they have a sense of legal impunity, because the cops know that there's going to be all these different legal defenses, qualified immunity, and other things that will make it almost impossible to hold them liable for killing peaceful American citizens. There was, you know, I was talking to Duncan Lemp's mother a year after he was killed. And she said to me, "I will always wonder whether the police intended to kill Duncan from the start. There was never a search." She said that the way that the police conducted themselves, it was as if they intended to kill him even before the raid began. And I don't know about your house, but I know there's a lot of folks in the area I was raised in back in the mountains of Virginia. If someone goes smashing in their windows at 4:30 a.m. and throwing bombs inside their house, there's going to be a shooting. Maybe there's going to be two shootings. I don't know. But I mean, and it's completely predictable. I mean, this is simple human nature. Even the New York Times had a great piece on this. Kevin Sachs was a writer, 2017, 2018. He talked about how it was predictable that when the cops go in with all this violence pre-dawn, wake people up, people grab a gun, and then the cops kill them. And it's like, Oh, that never happened before. That never happened before, except for last week and the week before, and 3 days before that, and 12 times the prior month. And it's just completely, it's a very servile attitude that the government can do this, can kill people, and then claim, well, it wasn't our intention to kill him. Well, then why did you start shooting into his house and smashing in the door and throwing in bombs before dawn?
Well, it also raises the question, at least in my mind, and obviously I've not done the extensive work into these areas that you have, but and as you've pointed out on numerous broadcasts that we've done here, that my idealism tends to get in the way of my government skepticism. But you think about what has to be done in order for the SWAT team to go into action. As my understanding is that first there has to be the problem. The problem has to be presented. It has to be taken to somebody, either somebody higher up the chain in the police department or a judge, usually a judge, who has to see the probable cause and give the authorization for for the move. And you would think that somewhere in that chain, when the only thing they've got is a couple of paid informants, yeah, always a reliable source, and a picture on the internet of a guy with a gun, which may have been illegal according to Maryland's wacky laws about the so-called assault weapons, you would think that cooler heads would prevail, and rather than send out, a bunch of guys and a SWAT team, they send out a couple of guys that, that would sit there and knock on the door and say, "Do you have this thing?" And so on. Like we've seen videos of the BATF in operation here recently, but the I, it's difficult to grasp how it is, why it is that someone like a judge, for example, or a captain or somebody high up in the police department would just say, "Oh, yeah, well, that's good enough. Go ahead. Take the guns, get out there, have a good time."
Well, I mean, this is what the police law enforcement has got on automatic pilot, and the judges, signed off on this. There was a part of how they got a no-knock search warrant for this was Duncan Lemp had posted a photo of a rifle on Instagram, tagged it to his hometown, Potomac, Maryland, and added a caption that said, "Green tip armor piercing gets the girls wet." And the police listed that in their the affidavit to get a no-knock search warrant, which became a death warrant for Duncan Lemp. But it's like, I mean, okay, there's lots of guys I know who post really stupid things on the internet, and some of them, not nearly as many as there used to be, post photos of themselves with weapons and stuff like that. Damned imprudent in this time and age, but. People do that, and it's just and okay. Here again, flashing back to where I was raised in the mountains of Virginia, I mean, people would bluster about their guns. They would have photos of their guns. It was common practice. It was just, it was standard redneck protocol. And yet, here in Montgomery County, it's like, oh my God, someone's got a gun. They put a picture on him. He's dangerous. We better kill him to keep the peace.
Well, interesting you should mention that, because that kind of goes along with the companion piece that that you had that talked about the it was in the New York Post about shedding a tear for our lost rights, and the fact that the there's a whole list of them there that you mentioned that go along it goes along with the book Lost Rights, Last Rights. Well, both Lost Rights and Last Rights,
Ha
as far as
ha!
that's concerned.
Whatever, whatever.
Yeah.
Hell, I have trouble keeping them straight, so I understand.
Well, the but the oversight is essentially the same with regards to a list of things like First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Second Amendment, privacy and education and lockdowns and all the rest of that that are just kind of just rolling over us, rolling over us, rolling over us. I find that rather remarkable that that's happening. But getting back to the hills of West Virginia, now we didn't have those kind of hills in northern New Jersey, but at least we were out in the country and
It
had a bunch
wasn't
of
West
chickens.
Virginia. It was the Shenandoah Valley, Virginia.
Ah, okay. So you had some flatland, but
You're raising
but
questions about my genetic pool.
no. I'm just trying to get oriented to my lack of geographical intelligence. But I'm just thinking about the what would happen at our house. So I have a father, a brother, a sister and mother. They knew where the guns were and how they worked. And on the other side of the farm were my grandparents who took care of the birds and so on. And there were firearms over there. But I'm thinking about Lemp, his pregnant girlfriend, and his mother. So who's gonna grab the gun? especially at 4:30 in the morning. I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is that one of the reasons that the SWAT teams operate at that time of the morning is because psychiatrists and so on have proven that that's when you are in your deepest sleep and will be most disoriented if someone should rudely awake you with a couple of bullets in your spine.
Yeah, these are the same psychologists who helped the CIA and military torture people at Guantanamo and other places.
Right, same justification.
There was a huge scandal that the American, the establishment therapists were so much in bed with the torture regime, and they were the ones that propelled it. But yes, that's the advice that's given to catch people at their most vulnerable, at their most disoriented, and then you compound that with flashbangs. But it's just it's those flashbangs, these no-knock raids. This is the perfect expression of how the government views its relation to the American people,
and vice versa. I mean, it seems like more and more Americans, except over in flyover country, it's like you said about oh my God, the guy's got a gun. He must be a whack job. I was going to get into your other article where you highlighted the red flag laws that the Biden administration are pushing in some state governors and states and so on. This is an exact example of how all you need is some Karen that got PO'd because you were playing music you didn't like. She calls the cops, says he's got guns, he's drunk, he's unstable. The next thing you know, there's all sorts of activity going on at your house.
Yeah, I mean, Maryland has already had, even prior to Duncan Lemp, there was a guy just outside of Annapolis, I think, who was a police come banging on his door at 5 a.m., tell him they're going to seize his guns. He starts arguing, then the cops kill him. And he was, he had no criminal record. He had no record of violence. Someone had reported him. And that was sufficient. And the there was a political police chief made the comment later the day after they killed the guys. Like, I don't know what would have happened if we hadn't gone there. Well, the dude would have still been alive if you hadn't shot him.
There's one.
Yeah.
Well, there was one other thing before we get to the clock is ticking. But I wanted to go back for a moment and go back to ask you when I was saying about cooler heads prevailing and how these things don't get short-circuited somewhere along the line by someone who's got a firmer grasp on the law and the Constitution and so on.
Law is not good at this point. The Constitution is good, but it's not being enforced.
Well, I've never known a piece of parchment to stop a bullet. I'll just put it that way. But the
good line.
But I am curious about if there's a parallel to this, and that was going through all the crap that they put Trump through with the Russian dossier and so on, and the fact that they kept going back to FISA, to the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and getting their permission and justification, authorization to go do what they did. And I'm thinking, well, there was, I think, was there two or three judges that sat on that FISA court? Didn't somebody have enough knowledge? Didn't any of them read the paper? I mean, this went on for 3 years. It was already pretty much out there that this FISA authorization was being granted. Didn't someone on the court sit there and say, some of this stuff looks a little cheesy about what you guys are doing here. Maybe we're not going to authorize this warrant that you want or this permission slip that you want.
Well, keep in mind how those judges for the FISA court are chosen. I think they're handpicked by the Chief Justice. And so it's not like folks who were skeptics who are going to stand up for the Fourth Amendment are going to be put on that court. But even the FISA judges every now and then say, we're very upset by the number of FBI lies in the affidavits lately. But they say, and it really needs to stop. However, in the meantime, the FBI can go spy on who they please.
Right. And so, Congress reauthorizes the bill.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. I shake my head ruefully and totter on the edge of cynicism.
I know it's you're just hanging on by a few fingernails, but I really admire your strength and determination in doing that. But these are all these questions that come up and come along when these things they crossbreed and infiltrate one subject to another, and it's and ultimately it comes down to without being redundant, this the last rights. I mean, these are things that are going on. They're not being questioned. They're being ridiculed. There's no knowledge, there's no passion, there's no nothing except the people who write and talk about it. And at least we don't have any pictures here. That's probably some salvation. But anyway, that bell you don't hear ringing in the background is the warning that the Bovard Curtain of Mercy is about to descend on our little chat fest here. And at this point, I need to mention that the two and only will be on hiatus. That's what they say in showbiz. Going to be away for a while one of us begins his conversion into a $6 million man, as borrowed from the TV show that's been on hiatus since 1978. Now, I don't think we're going to be gone for 46 years, but it's going to take some time for stitches to heal and recover from the freezer burns from the refrigerated bedpans. So if you let your mouse and fingers wander over to Brian Wilson Writes at Substack.com, you can grab a free subscription and you'll be the third to know when we will once again invade your space with a smattering of satire and broadsides of verbal ballistics aimed at the swamp creatures and cretins polluting the Washington swamp. Meanwhile, get your copy of Last Rites so you know what we're talking about. It's over at Amazon. And grab a copy of 50 Stories, 50 Years in Radio while you're at it. Chances are we'll be back before you get to the last chapter. Members of our studio audience today will be getting a full Monty portrait of Maryland Towelhead Jamie Raskin, suitable for framing, gift wrapping fish, or house training puppies. The Two and Only is directed by Jim Badley and Brian Dunn as a Badley Dunn production. Thanks for joining us. Till next time, for the prolific James Bovard, this is the profligate Brian Wilson reminding you, the government says we're making progress. Things are getting worse at a much slower rate. See you next time, whenever that may be.